Hello, listeners. I regret to inform you that you've stumbled upon a storm of spoilers. This week's podcast is very sad and the kind of audio entertainment that might have you straining to listen through tragic tears as your heartstrings are tugged, knotted, and burnt, like so many threads of the twisting tale of the Baudelaire orphans, woven through 13 books, a couple of spin-offs, a four-book prequel series, some of which, but not all of which, were used to create the Netflix adaptation, A Series of Unfortunate Events. Adaptation, which in this case means it was a book first with a lot of plot, and now a TV show is catching up just like Game of Thrones. However, dear listener, nothing in this podcast is better than taking the time to attend the Duchess of Winnipeg's pony party, or, more vital, than continuing the search for the Sugar Bowl. The world is quiet, but not on podcasts. This is all very unseen. Maybe stop listening. Hello and welcome to the Storm of Spoilers off-season tour. My name is Dave Gonzalez, which in this instance means the host of a very detailed-oriented podcast.
My name is Joanna Robinson, which in this instance means someone who is unable to leave social and political issues out of any conversation.
And I'm Neil Miller, which in this instance means that I am concerned that Melina Weissman looks a little too much like Emily Browning, and it's very confusing.
That's a very fitting thing, Neil, in terms of the how you make a in this instance joke, which is it has to be incredibly specific. Good job. We are, of course, doing A Series of Unfortunate Events. If you did not know, based on that format of introductions, it is a book series that became a Netflix adaptation of the first four volumes that ended up being an adaptation of, I think, a little bit more than that. We're going to talk about all of that in this upcoming episode of Storm of Spoilers. But first, Joanna, do we have any new reviews?
We sure do, Dave. All right. This review comes from Brandon R. Five stars, 5 out of 5 polygons. I believe that's all the polygons you can get, which is pretty great.
Max. Thanks, polygons, Brandon. Very well.
Brandon R. This podcast is one of my favorites. I started listening to Cast of Kings during season 6 of Game of Thrones. When the season ended and I was hungry for more, I went back and listened to Joanna's other podcast. It's great for a non-book reader like me to gain more context of the story. The off-season tour has been especially fulfilling. They cover properties I wouldn't normally dig into myself, like Harry Potter and the Cursed Child, which made for a fantastic discussion. I love Star Wars, but Dave's nerdy know-how helped fill in some gaps for me. Also, to anyone who complains about the social issues being incorporated into the conversation, hey, when you listen to a podcast about TV and movies, you are inherently agreeing that this is art that has more than surface value. There is always political subtext that relates to the real world. My one complaint, and I agree with this.
Okay, all right.
My one complaint is that Neil's voice sounds an awful lot like Spencer's voice on Harmontown, another favorite podcast of mine.
I'm taking that as a compliment. Spencer's awesome.
I love Spencer. Yeah. Everyone loves Spencer. It's a great compliment. Keep doing what you guys are doing. P.S. If you read this on air, Joanna, please do in the voice of Dan Harmon trying to do an Australian accent. I like that hat, mate. And it's all like capitalized and punctuated perfectly. So thank you, Brandon R., and for the continued crossover Harmontown Storm of Spoilers love.
Nice.
Yeah. That happened. Say that, Neil.
What?
That happened.
Wait. Say it as monotone as possible.
That happened.
Yes. See? Oh my God. It is. It's perfect.
I do think it's interesting that this review brought up social context, because the social context of this week's topic is everything's terrible.
Yeah. Everything's terrible. Adults don't know anything. Basically lines up with the worldview right now.
Look away when poor defenseless children are being victimized.
Look away. There you go.
We're going to talk more about that song, I'm sure, in the future. Let me just say, if you're going to have songs, don't rhyme the same syllable with the exact same syllable.
Wait, can I ask a question to make sure I know?
Sure.
Did we already say what our topic was this week?
We did. Series of Unfortunate Events.
Okay. I must have missed it. I'm sorry. I wanted to make sure.
Did you forget what we were talking about this week?
No, I thought we were making all these references and Dave hadn't officially done his, like, this week we're talking about the Netflix original series, A Series of Unfortunate Events. Like, I didn't hear him say that. He usually goes, like, based on the Lemony Snicket books, like, that whole thing. Are you sure?
Oh, yeah. I even said that there were some books that we didn't know that might have been adapted into it.
Wow.
There
was like okay, a 20 where was I? Sorry. Okay.
Looking up reviews diligently, I am sure.
Yes.
I'm back.
The other part of this preamble section of the podcast is Neil stops by our old citadel to clean off some raven poop and to check on the newest Game of Thrones news. Neil, we got some stuff?
Yes, freshly de-pooped news.
Excellent.
In fact, I just want to read this quote, and I'm going to let it hang and see what you guys have to say. Earlier this week, Maisie Williams, in an interview, said on the topic of spoilers, "It's such a childish, annoying thing to do. And yeah, it's sad. It really annoys me."
Sad. You know, I mean, she went on to say more things, and one of them was like how she was frustrated that some of the leaks definitely come from within the production, and that really frustrates her, and how they're just trying to do a cool thing, and it really frustrates her. And I feel like we talked about this before when Weiss and Benioff gave their whole like spoilers are assholes to Entertainment Weekly. But obviously, we don't quite agree with Maisie and Dan and Dave. Bless them though. And you know, the point I made then, and I'll make it again, is that this series, the popularity of the series, is built on a fan base that already knew what was going to happen, which are book readers. Book readers are why Game of Thrones is like got a foothold in the first place.
Well, yeah, it's all the people that invited their friends over for the Red Wedding episode and just watched their friends.
Exactly. Like there have always been people knowing what's going to happen on Game of Thrones since the show started. This isn't new. So that kind of, maybe hypocrisy is too strong, but it feels like hypocrisy bothers me. Like if that weren't the case, I feel like they would have higher moral ground to stand on, but I don't feel like they do. What do you think, Dave?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm buying a childishannoyingthingtodo.com, which will host Storm of Spoilers by the time this episode goes up.
What was the Dan and Dave quote? End of great books?
The last chapters of great books or something like that. Right. Whatever that is, that also still leads to us.
Lastchaptersofgreatbooks.com, I think, yeah.
Nice.
But, you know, anytime that the cast itself wants to come out and tell us we're doing something wrong, you bet. You bet I'll buy that domain.
I will say this, in fairness to Maisie Williams, I think she was talking a lot about like the people who leak stuff from the script, or the photographers who are crawling through the weeds, and not necessarily about the community around it.
Right.
I wrote the post for the drone thing that got the Poe Dameron X-Wing from The Force Awakens, so she is most certainly talking about me, which I understand completely.
I feel like Neil is I feel like Neil's right. She is talking about the photographer crowd, like crawling through the bushes, but like we can't really separate separate ourselves from them, because we take those photos, which we might do in a little bit in the section, and then talk about them. So, you know, we're not crawling through the bushes ourselves, no, but we're disseminating that information, yes. So, yeah. If it's evil, we're complicit, but I don't think it's evil. I really don't.
That's fair. I don't think it's evil either.
No, and I do a lot of childish, annoying things.
Most of them like, on air.
Like ruin M. Night Shyamalan movies for your poor unsuspecting co-host.
Still sore.
But yeah, like that.
Like that.
All right, moving on.
I did it for the clicks.
To our next topic, which actually Joanna wrote a big article this week on Vanity Fair. In Vanity Fair is a different thing, right? On VanityFair.com.
True.
That George R. R. Martin is, and some folks on the internet pointed out that he is going to be part of this anthology called Book of Swords by an author whose name I can't pronounce, which is fine. But George is going to be writing a piece of it, and is going to be a story set in Westeros. And Joanna, would you like to tell us more about what that story will probably entail?
Yeah, he has confirmed today via a blog post that he wrote that it is exactly what the book nerds guessed it was, which is The Sons of the Dragon, which is a story, which is, guess what, a Targaryen story that he's read at like a number of conventions over the years, like bits from. And it's one of the stories that will probably, which he hopes will someday end up in something that he calls the Grimmarillion, which is the Cimmerillion, but like G-R-R-M in the front
the
of it.
The Grimmarillion.
Yeah, but apparently he pronounces it Grimmarillion, like that's how he's pronounced it at conventions and stuff. And so it's a bunch of Targaryen history. I think he's, like, it would officially be called the Book of, what is it? The Book of Fire and Blood. It would be called Fire and Blood. And it's a Targaryen history. And so if you're not into history, then this is not the George R. R. Martin story for you. But it tells some of the stories of like Aegon the Conqueror and some of his brothers and sons and all of that. It's the early, early days of the Targaryens. It's history. And Martin even said on his blog post today something about, you know, in my books, I do show, don't tell, which is, you know, always good writing advice. And in his histories, he does like tell, not show. So yeah, so it's like the Cimmerillion. If you've read the Cimmerillion or even like started to read and been like, no, thank you. It is not like a page turning novel. It's more dry history. But if you're a deep fried nerd and that is not an insult. It's a compliment. Then the Sons of the Dragon might be for you. And yeah, this is going to be in the anthology called Book of Swords, which is going to be out in October. So that is what George R. R. Martin is doing instead of finishing.
I was interested. I was struck by the headline, the lead of your piece, which was something about whether or not Game of Thrones is sort of getting to him.
That's based on, I mean, this was based on the assumption that this was going to be the Sons of the Dragon, which it is.
Mm-hmm.
And basically my thesis, I mean, you can read the whole piece if you want, because I plucked a lot of Martin quotes from the past few years. But it's basically just looking at like the pieces that he has published or the Winds of Winter chapters he has released. And so much of it is stuff that has nothing to do with the show. And it just feels like more and more, we've talked about this before, but more and more that he's just distancing himself. Like, I just don't. I think the luster of being entwined with the show has worn off for him because you can blame him if you want. I choose to support George, but if you want to be mad at George for not publishing his books faster, that's fine. But it's still disappointing to probably to him to not be the one to reveal what happens to Jon Snow, to not be the one to reveal the Hodor thing, you know, for the show to be not only plowing forward, but sort of taking ownership of the story that he started, especially with all the changes they're making. So I my sense, and this is both extrapolation based on what he has published, which has been stories about like characters who aren't in the book or like Sansa, who is, you know, nowhere near her show version, like all the stuff that he's published has nothing really to do with the books. And maybe that's in his contract, but, It just seems to me that he's put some space. And it also, extrapolating further, and I swear, there's a lot of quotes from him in there, so I swear I'm not just like wildly conjecturing, but extrapolating further, I would say it might be why it's taking him so long to write The Winds of Winter, because I think he is feeling conflicted and frustrated over losing control of his own story through his own frailties. And, you know, also as he's promised, trying to cram in a bunch of new twists and turns that the HBO show can't possibly do. So those are my thoughts.
Here's my question. This is going to require a prediction.
Neil Stradamus strikes again.
Well, I'm going to make you predict it first and then we'll see if I agree. What do you think is more likely in, let's say, the next 5 years, that George finishes Winds of Winter and writes A Dream of Spring, or that George finishes the Winds of Winter, because it's almost done anyway, and then signs on to oversee / write a prequel series for HBO?
Like, I have to... Maybe the second. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I feel like Weiss and Benioff do not want to do this prequel series.
Right.
And so, you know, if George gets to be the showrunner, is that what you're saying? Like, George is
the showrunner?
Well, yeah,
you would think that if HBO can't get Weiss and Benioff, which they probably won't be able to do, then they would want, and maybe they could hand the showrunner duties off to, you know, one of the other producers that they've used along the way, but they'd want George involved in that case.
Yeah, I mean, I think it depends what the prequel series is about, if it's Duncan Egg or if it's the Targaryens. Like, I think George has said Duncan Egg, but I feel like they're going to do Targaryens. And that's why all these Targaryen stories sort of, I don't know, we talked about this on the mailbag episode, sort of what we thought the prequel series would be about. But what do you think, Neil, and also Dave?
Dave, what do you think? What's more likely?
Once you guys said Grimmarillion, I was like, do we all get a Marillion to like get the bits and pieces of our left out work?
A DA7
Like, I wrote a lot
Marillion.
About Spider-Man, but the Dave Marillion, that one's going to tell you what I thought about Batman. I mean, like, what? But, you know, I'll take either of those prequel options. I do think that after Joanna's, psychoanalyzing of George R. R. Martin's possible headspace, that I would want him to just nose to the grindstones and finish the book. I feel like that would make him creatively as happy, because he's always going to be George R. R. Martin. Even if the HBO prequel series sucks, he could grab a, you know, check and go do some readings of something else, and eventually he'll be remembered as the author and creator more than
the question at this point is, does he have another book in him? Because he's not to the finish line after the Winds of Winter. So I do think it feels more likely that he is sort of burned out telling this version of the story, and by the time he gets anywhere near his finish line, the show will have done it. And
we'll have done a version of it. I mean, right. There's another thing to maybe be said about being able to see the ending of your show before you write the ending of your novel. Like, I know that he's, you know, big on planning, and there are lots of like threads going up and down, but hopefully he's learning things about storytelling. 'Cause wasn't that like the start? Does he wanted to do like a not film, not television, like fantasy novel that had like real stakes, and now, you know, the media has evolved to maybe be able to portray that. Maybe George needs to push it further.
Maybe. I feel like you're on the other side of this. I think prequel series, you think he might want to finish the books.
Well, I think he would be happier if he just stuck to being an author and cashed some checks and raised his wolves.
I know I would. I think you're right. Like, if I could wave my magic wand and get George to do anything, I would say, work your like bearded ass off, finish both books, and fucking scoop HBO. But he's not going to do that. That's not how he works.
Right.
At all. But he would, like, he would be so, are you kidding? He'd be so happy if he's like, guess what, motherfuckers? My ending's coming out first.
Or what if, now this is like the ultimate, what if he came out and the reason why The Winds of Winter is taking so long is because this is it. Like, there is no next book.
It ends.
That would be pretty dope. Like, if he dropped that in between season 7 and 8, and he's like, boom, you know, ending. And
he kills and the then Dream if we of Spring. That, there yep. is no Dream of Spring.
Yep. Yeah.
It would just be cool if he like figured that out like a year ago, and I want to still be in the plan of a creator. Like, I know we're pushing the edges of it from every possible way, but I still want to be like, you know, rocked to sleep knowing that somebody has the ending in mind and that we're on a scheduled train to get there.
Yeah, wasn't it just about a year ago? Like, it was January that he announced last year that Winds of Winter wasn't coming, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you could have taken a whole year and just finished it. I mean, now we're just
poor George.
Upon that,
he was probably just raising wolves, watching football, eating snacks, drinking drinks. Like, George is kind of living a great life. He's just not living the life that we insist he lives.
Yeah, I mean, if I were George, I would have stopped after book three and been like, "Cool, you guys take it from here." But I'm lazy. So, all right. So I have two more. These are really just fun facts, part of our Game of Thrones. Two more ravens that came through. One, I think we might have talked about this, but this felt newish to me. And it was Conleth Hill in an interview this week talked about how he originally read for the role of Robert Baratheon. Did we know that already?
If I knew it, I forgot it. Because when I saw on the show notes, I was like, really? But I'm sure there's probably video. I'll look for video. But
yeah, I feel like it's something I knew and forgot.
Yeah, I think so too. Yeah.
And then they are still filming. And they are filming in Iceland, and the people that have been seen near the black shores of Iceland, which does not necessarily mean they're in scenes together, but they could be in scenes together, Joe Dempsey, Liam Cunningham, and Rory McCann, which I had not heard a lot about Rory McCann so far this year, but hey, the hound's still alive, Clegane Bowl, the dream lives, so maybe.
There's also, we know that IMDb is like full of bullshit nonsense, right?
Mm-hmm.
But a June 25th release date popped up for season 7, episode 1 on IMDb this last week. Mm-hmm. And wait, I know, full of bullshit, but wait for it. There's something else. This is not the article I was reading, but someone else had done like a an analysis, and it was based actually on like a foreign affiliate, which said they were introducing a new HBO series every month, and they planned it out, and it was like, it said that it basically like said that Game of Thrones had to come in June, so we'll see. This is all conjecture.
Are we gonna be at a wedding for this premiere episode, Joanna?
I think so.
God damn it.
But at least, you know, we'll be among friendly bloggers, so it'll be fine.
Well, it's going to be a long wait for this thing.
Wow.
But I think if it's anything like the Rick and Morty IMDb premiere date, it's just full of shit. And it just exists to raise you up for a second and then get crashed down around your ears.
Sorry. That would mean that the week after the first episode of the new season, we would be in Nashville for Con of Thrones. Right?
Yeah, Con of Thrones is suddenly becoming a thing.
Wow. Wow.
Like it's going to be happening while the things are happening.
Could you imagine?
Man, you guys better
okay, cool.
Go to that website and get the things done.
Yep.
Right, Joanna?
Yeah, go to conofthrones.com. I'm trying to figure out what that other... Okay, sorry. It's probably useless. And then the don't go looking for the date, June 25th, because it's already gone. So really, you know, it could
be
whatever.
There for a second. And maybe it adds up with math, but
maybe not.
We're just
maybe math. Maybe math is bullshit.
For all I know, math is bullshit. Facts sometimes aren't what they appear.
We're gonna have alternative math on this show from now on.
I was told there wouldn't be math, so
that's alternative math is not technically math. That's
okay,
important.
Fair enough.
Cool.
All right, let's shut off the Game of Thrones for another week. And you can, of course, find this podcast at achildishannoyingthingtodo.com and lastpagesofgreatbooks.com as we move on to a series of unfortunate events. So, guys, I guess we'll start off. Neil, what was your experience, if any, with Lemony Snicket's Little Yarn before you watched the first season on Netflix?
I had watched at least 30 minutes of the movie that came out in the 2004?
The Nickelodeon movie?
Sure.
The Jim Carrey movie, I guess, would be the better way of describing it.
I don't remember much about it, except that it had Jim Carrey, Jude Law, and Emily Browning. Yep, that's literally all I remember about that. And then I watched this. I have never read any of the books. And I did not know that Lemony Snicket was a real person writing under a pen name until earlier this week. So very little knowledge going in, which is, I guess, why I found it super charming. Because I'm like, oh, this is just so different. And
oh, good.
It's like probably the people who have seen this over and over again or read the books are probably like, well, yeah, it's like the same thing. But I was like, oh, this is charming.
What charmed you about it? Because I know the tone, especially for the first book and for the movie, I think for the first half, is sort of hard to nail down. And the Netflix series definitely attempts to hit that same tone. Did that work for
you?
Well,
yeah, and I think it's Patrick Warburton that really sells it in that it is a story that is sort of morose and grim thematically. But it's also extremely self-aware about its own grimness that it becomes fun. It's like, you know, I think we were joking, either in chat or off air about it being like Barry Sonnenfeld doing Tim Burton. But it all it does feel like some of those early Tim Burton movies where they're really dark, sometimes literally, but they also just have a kind of fun, lighthearted spirit about them. I think of Edward Scissorhands in that way, where it's a particularly dark story. It's got some really grim, you know, things to say, but it's still fun and sort of magical and ethereal. And so I think that mix is a really interesting mix, and it gives the show a really cool energy. And Patrick Warburton could sit there in a monotone and read the phone book, and I'd probably be in for at least the first 200 pages. So, so that really, really makes it work. And, you know, I think the difference that I found in this series versus what I remember of the 2004 movie is that Neil Patrick Harris is sort of a more subdued version of Count Olaf. He's a little bit, I felt like he was actually a little bit more sinister because he wasn't as over the top as Jim Carrey, because Jim Carrey at that point in his career couldn't do anything subtly. So
yeah, no, I remember watching the Count Olaf does a T-Rex scene in theaters and just being like, what is this doing in this story? And luckily, I feel like the Netflix series managed to sidestep that.
Mm-hmm.
Joanna, you have a little bit more experience with the books. Explain that, and then your thoughts on the Netflix series.
Sure. The first book came out in like 1999, when I was in college, and if you guys want to do some math, that's dating myself, but but I don't think I read them until like 2002 or something like that. There are 13 books. I think the last one was published in 2006, I think, or 2005. Anyway, point being, 13 books came out in a short period of time. They were sort of running concurrently with Harry Potter, which is why they get kind of compared to Harry Potter a lot, even though the tone is totally different, but they're shelved in the same section. So I guess that's why. And as many of you know, when I left college, I started doing author events in San Francisco. Lemony Snicket is a pseudonym for the author Daniel Handler, who lives in San Francisco, was probably the most famous, in terms
guy
of...
guy you could bring event people to see?
Yeah, in terms of selling books at the time, you know, like Amy Tan, like there are other authors who live in San Francisco, but he was like, you know, selling books and living in San Francisco. So we would not only do author events for him, for the series of Fortune events, but we'd also like... or Michael Chabon too. Anyway, the Michael Chabon and Daniel Handler neck and neck. They would be at like every event to like introduce authors, to interview authors. So I've worked with Daniel Handler a lot, and I've done a lot of Lemony Snicket signing events, which are really fun because of course Daniel Handler never admits that he's Lemony Snicket. He just insults the children. They love it. They laugh and laugh and laugh, and he's really mean to them. And then he doesn't sign the books. He has like an embossing tool that he embosses the books, writes the date, and then like with regrets or with respect or like, you know, like these dour little things for them, and they love it and they eat it up. So that's my like lengthy, and I got to know him very well, like in his off hours, and he's never really off. He's always sarcastic. So his voice is very familiar to me. So it's really funny to see Patrick Warburton as sort of an alter ego. I think he's a much better alter ego than Jude Law was, in terms of a match. I feel like Patrick Warburton is like, if you, Dave, you, Neil, or I like sat here and like cast our like the most handsome, perfect version of ourselves, but was still like, I could see that as the most attractive version of you. I feel like Patrick Warburton's a really good mix for match for Daniel Handler.
Mine would be Ben Affleck, by the way.
Nice. and Ben Affleck with a beard. Like the beard feels like a must. Okay.
Yeah.
So all that's to say that I've read all 13 books. I have not read the prequel books or the unauthorized biography of Lemony Snicket. I did see the original film. I did not like it very much. I watched these 8 episodes. I liked Neil Patrick Harris the most in the last two when he got to play a lady. I thought that was the very best thing Neil Patrick Harris got to do. The tone of it was very good. I think the issue for me with it, though, and the set design, and like Handler was much more hands-on with this than he was with the film.
He scripted all of it.
Yeah, he scripted all of it. He was just in charge of a lot of decisions. He was like basically EPing this thing. And so I think tonally and visually and he wrote like the lyrics for the music and like all the stuff, like it all really matches very well. I found the on-screen version of the children pretty boring. And I can't remember if that was the case in the book. But like, I'm rooting for them, of course. They're the victim of unfortunate events. But, yeah. I mean, I'll leave the baby out of this because it's a baby and it's voiced by Tara Strong of Harley Quinn fame. But, you know.
And Tommy Pickles fame.
Okay. but Klaus and Violet, I don't know. They just seem like a non-entity to me. And so any scenes where they're just talking to each other, I found my attention wandering. So that would be my first reaction to the whole thing.
For sure. I mean, I'm going to pick up sort of there because I agree with you. I've read the 13 books, but way back when The End came out, which is 2000-something, and also was unaware that there were unauthorized biographies and 4 Lemony Snicket prequel adventures, which are actually kind of noirish. So I did a little bit of reading because I watched this series and was like, I don't remember this much like extra stuff happening because the series of unfortunate events books doesn't really unveil that it's about anything except the Baudelaires really until I guess like book 4 or 5. It's a while before like the whole idea of a secret organization comes out, and unlike the Netflix series where we get Kobe Smulders and Will Arnett in the first episode playing a mother and father, we like none of the series takes place entirely from the perspective of the children, and because of that, and then because of where the series eventually goes, where the children start kind of questioning their own morality, I feel like it was a lot easier to take the children as protagonists in the books. Here, I feel like expanded over a Netflix series, it's definitely a portrayal of the world and the full world, including like the weird mystery backstory and the, you know, Easter eggs on the side of the frame being portrayed much better than it has before. But it's unable to sort of like penetrate the children in a way where the audience become their surrogates. We're always with Patrick Warburton sort of being told what's going to happen and whatnot, which in some ways softens the blow, like when people die, because, you know, you get led up to the fact they're going to die and they use the dramatic irony tension a lot. But on the other hand, you're not like particularly worried for like Sunny or Klaus because at some point, well, I guess at some point, in the first episode when Olaf hits Klaus and is holding Sunny above his head, it's like the only time that I think the series puts the kids in like a non-cartoonish danger, and it's early enough that you're trying to put hooks in the kids, so I think that was really effective. But by the time you're getting to the mill stuff, it's more like I was waiting for the next scene to show me the performance or the wordplay that it thought it was clever and then drag it out, because the Netflix series has the same Netflix drag problem where they turned like a children's book into 2 episodes per book. And so they put in all this other stuff, which is good, but they're still letting the performers sort of breathe within that space or spending a lot of time doing word games or flashback games or what happened first, or, you know, which in this case means, you know, teaching people the meaning of dramatic irony, sort of real or false. It's all sort of like plops it in to make it a series of pleasurable vignettes that look like someone threw, Edward Scissorhands and, gave some it's, Wes Anderson.
It's like, yeah,
some
it's
Quaaludes,
like Edward Scissorhands meets Moonlight Kingdom.
Moonrise Kingdom,
sorry.
But then also it doesn't have the pace. It has the Edward Scissorhands pace, not the Moonrise Kingdom pace, which I think starts hurting it at some times, where I'm like, why am I watching Mr. Poe again right now? Why am I not with the kids?
Right.
And I guess...
I just want to say really quickly that your style references really crack me up, because earlier today I was watching that SNL sketch, The Sinister Coterie of Midnight Intruders, which is the Wes Anderson fake horror movie trailer that they did. That's like a perfect, it's a perfect match for what we're watching here. So,
for sure. Anyway, but I was really impressed by it. It's just, I hope that as they move on, much like the book series did, it sort of starts to pick up the pace and draw some more of these threads together. I don't know if I just need to abandon trying to have the Baudelaires as like my place in the story and just start, you know, realizing that there's more and that I'm more Lemony Snicket connecting yarn lines to newspaper clippings than I am on the side of these orphans, which also might be partially informed by how the books actually end, because it's not like there's a big conclusion at the end of book 13 that makes everybody feel nice.
So Entertainment Weekly interviewed Daniel Handler, and they asked him, they're like, is there any stuff that's not in the book? Like, I think they were basically trying to get him to say, don't worry, I've like actually solved some of the mysteries in the show that I didn't solve in the book. But he basically says no. Well, he made it self-deprecating and dour, but the other thing he did say is that they're doing 10 episodes for season 2. And they're doing, the next 5 books. So it's still going to be two episodes per book. And then the last season will cover the final books. So they're doing 3 seasons, but it's still going to be two episodes per book, which Handler really likes because he always envisioned his stories as sort of like a Perils of Pauline serial. So I think he likes that they're doing like cliffhangers and part 1 and part 2 and that sort of stuff.
You say he always did, but they don't begin to be serialized until like 4, 5, or 6, maybe, in terms of like actually picking up. It's like my problem with the first couple of Serious But Fortunate Events books is it's the pattern. It's like the Harry Potter pattern that should have gotten boring by like book 3, but didn't, because we kept seeing different parts of the Hogwarts school year. Doesn't have the room to breathe in Series of Unfortunate Events, where it's like kids show up, things are bad. Olaf shows up, nobody believes them. Things get worse, kids have to leave when they, you know, unmask Olaf, you know, rinse and repeat with Poe. I mean, eventually that gets discarded and, you know, things evolve for the Baudelaire's children in the world. But I don't think that they're... I like a lot of things that were done in the Netflix series, like sort of making it more... having like a book and library and literary theme, which was always there in the book, but I feel is really forward. Like if you make a literary allusion in the Netflix series, it really pops. Whereas if you like, you know, make a literary allusion in a book, it's like you're sort of in that world anyway. But then on the other hand, I feel like there could have been more content in the Baudelaire children spaces, or even more perils for them in the adventures I knew that they had, to sort of like fill everything out. Like I feel like the Mill episode's a good example. Like you're saying, good Neil Patrick Harris thing. They finally put to rest the whole is Sir gay, by just like putting it right out there at the beginning, being like, yes, this is a gay couple. That's the most we're going to talk about it. Like all of those sort of small adaptations were great. I kind of wish they pushed it more in the direction of what I thought the Kobe Smulders, Will Arnett stuff was before, you know, the end reveal of the season that we're actually seeing the Quagmires.
I think that makes sense to me. What do you think, Neil?
Sure. I will say I have thoughts. Not all of them are related to what you guys are talking about. One is I am curious to find, or I guess not so curious, because maybe this is easier to understand in the books, but the parents thing, the mother and father thing, that threw me off all the way to the twist. Like I thought those are their parents.
Right.
The show does a pretty good job of disguising it. But I think that allowed me to be more invested in the kids, because I was like, oh my God, they need to find their parents. Their parents aren't dead. But their parents are dead, I'm pretty sure, at this point.
Yeah.
I have a few thoughts about the 2004 movie that I would like to share.
Let's do it.
I'm ready.
Two things. One, I did not know that Catherine O'Hara was in both. I forgot that. She played...
Justice Strauss,
and then she played the doctor in the series.
I have to say, Joan Cusack was like born to play that justice role.
Oh, for sure. Well, I mean, Joan Cusack is amazing.
Joan Cusack is a well-meaning, I mean, maybe it's just I watch too much Shameless, but Joan Cusack is like a well-meaning person who is blind to terrible people around her. I like her.
She just believed in Lloyd Dobler once and it paid off, and now she could just go on believing in everybody.
Right.
All right, sorry, Neil.
Also, I think that the 2004 A Series of Unfortunate Events is the only movie in which Meryl Streep and Cedric the Entertainer are among the cast. Like, I feel like that's the only even remote possibility for that, which I think is great.
This is why we needed a, yeah. It's got to be something else those two could be in.
But it makes me want, like, a buddy cop movie where it's Cedric the Entertainer and Meryl Streep.
Listen, don't we all, though?
Sorry, that's completely unrelated to all the intricate book-related adaptation stuff that is gold for this podcast. But I have nothing to add.
Did you like the vocab lessons? Because I really like them, but a bunch of people on Twitter told me they found them annoying.
Oh no, I like that stuff. I like any show that is sort of invested in something beyond its narrative, like that works in some sort of nerdiness to its narrative, whether it's science or language. That's one of the things that struck me as very interesting about this show. It's like, oh, this is a cute show with a really specific tone, but it's also got all this like cool language stuff. It really feels like the kind of show that you'd want like a 10 to 12 year old to watch. Because it sort of shows you that it's okay to be interested in that. It's okay to be bookish and be interested in that stuff. Like the quote unquote heroes of this show, the kids, are these, you know, this nerdy little family. And I think that's great. So there's that.
It's not on his Wikipedia because he's not that famous. But I'm trying to figure out how old... I know Daniel Handler has a son named Otto, but I don't know how old he is. And he was saying sort of in that Entertainment Weekly interview that like he didn't have a kid when he wrote the books, but he has a kid now. And so like in making the TV series, he was very – like the book series is praised for being something that both kids and adults could read, and I certainly read it as an adult. But like I think a lot of those like nerdy, cheeky literary references. Like, you know, you've got siblings named Isadora and Duncan, which is a like nod to the dancer Isadora Duncan, or like Edgar and Alan are the names
Georgina,
of the Poe kids.
What's her name? Georgina Orwell.
Right, exactly. Mm-hmm. So like stuff like this is there for like smug NPR listeners like myself to be like, oh, I get that reference. I have a classic education. You know, and then their kids can read it. Sales right over the kids' heads, but the kids have stuff that they can enjoy. So, it was praised for that, but I think, you know, Daniel Handler might be even more aware of what it takes to entertain a child now that he has one. So I'm curious. I have no idea. I have no sample study of like whether or not children are enjoying the series at all. I'd like to hope they are though.
And it really goes back to the thing that we talked about when we talked about the OA and some of the things that Netflix is doing with its creators, around just allowing these things to be different. You know, and I know that this is an existing property from the 90s that's been around and actually been made and made over again, but it's allowing the very large Netflix audience to just experience different kinds of entertainment that are not the same cookie cutter stuff that you would see on networks or that you're going to see at the box office. I think that's really cool. And I think that, you know, you talked about Daniel Handler's involvement. It's funny, I had a conversation with Macon Blair, who directed a movie at Sundance called I Don't Feel at Home in This World Anymore, which I think we talked about last week. But he was telling me just how open Netflix was to allowing him to just do his thing. Like,
right.
Like they let him cast whoever he wanted. They basically gave him the money for, you know, whatever. And, you know, that he's a first time director and, you know, so to make this series, to have Daniel Handler so involved, I think it really shows a commitment to creators that I think is very important in making things that match the voice of the people who are creating them. So
yeah, I don't like to give Netflix too much credit because like they're ruining my life. One, you know, every single week that they release a new TV series, like they're just driving me crazy. But that being said, like Handler said exactly that, and he also said that he's friends with Piper Kerman, who wrote Orange Is the New Black, and so like he knew from her that Netflix really was serious about letting creators do their thing. And he said that he's writing the scripts for season two of the series. He's writing in his dining room, which is fucking San Francisco, with his staff of writers. Like the series of unfortunate events writers have to squat in San Francisco for as long as it's going to take to write season two. So that's pretty cool. And yeah, you're right. Like the tone is just so clear, and not that the film was so far off the mark, but it's such a specific tone that's informed by like Edward Gorey and Roald Dahl and all this other stuff, this like steampunky, you know, death circus
I think thing. It's like non-determinate technology, Victorian Americanism from 1880 to 1930.
With the 1950s too, because like Putty's definitely the 1950s, right? So it's like
that's a good point.
Yeah, it's very odd, but you're right, like very specific to Handler. And so like I think it's a nightmare to adapt, but like if you've got the guy right there to be like, yep, nope, yep, nope, you know, like that makes mm-hmm. sense to me. The other thing that I was going to say about that, nope, it's gone. It's gone out of my head forever. Well, I was going to say that we should maybe talk about the music. You know, because this isn't like a musical, but there's a couple songs, like not just the opening credit song, which changes with every episode, with episode specific lyrics, but there's also like a few songs sprinkled throughout. I really liked the closing song a lot. It was a sort of a Magnolia, everyone sings No Frogs from the Sky, but otherwise, yes.
Yeah, the minute Patrick Warburton, you see him sitting on the rock and he starts singing, I'm like, yes, this is what I'm here for.
I know, I kind of wanted more of that. I'm like, do more of this, please. But it should be noted that, you know, Daniel Handler is friends with Stephen Merritt, who's the lead singer of the Magnetic Fields. The Magnetic Fields actually did an album, a Series of Unfortunate Event album, that is 13 songs, one song per book. And even though Merritt gets no credit on this music and, it's a different composer and Handler writing the lyrics, it feels so Death Circus-y Magnetic Fields to me, the music, it's such a specific aesthetic. It's such a strong vibe. So I would love for them to do more music like that closing number. They should have a musical closing number every single episode instead of a cliffhanger. That's my demand for season two.
Ooh.
10 new songs. Go.
I only like the last song because the other songs rhyme things like away with way and count with accountant. And I just am very particular about that.
I think,
but I realize that's a me being picky thing.
No, I think the last song was far and away the best song. The count opening number, I was like, well, it's Patrick Warburton. I should be excited that this is getting musical. And I wasn't. And I really did prefer him in disguise rather than as Count Olaf. There's something about the Count Olaf makeup, like that it was like too close to Jim Carrey or not close enough or whatever it is, or his eyeballs aren't expressive enough the way that Jim Carrey's are, that like he wasn't really coming through that makeup for me. But like in his other guises, I felt like he came to life a bit more.
Yeah, I think Neil Patrick Harris has tiny eyes.
Yeah.
That, you know, was really helped him playing Barney and you know, How I Met Your Mother, but it did not help him here. How did you guys feel about the Netflix specific asides?
Those were kind of fun. There was two of them.
Which ones were they?
There's like two or three.
Where
there'd be times where they would mention like, why would somebody go to the movies when it's much more comfortable to stream from home?
Ugh, I hate that shit.
My streaming entertainment. Grab a book or some streaming entertainment. Things like such.
I did like the one I did like was Neil Patrick Harris was like, what does he say? Like something about like in the last episode, like it's been a year or a week or a
week,
day,
or a season.
Yeah. Like that one I did like, but any mention of streaming I could do without.
Or the I've had some problems with the Nickelodeons was the Nickelodeon jab from Count Olaf.
Nah.
I mean, that stuff's fine. Like it's funny.
No, I like it. I was wondering if maybe it kicked the wrong, especially since you're dealing with a world where there isn't a computer.
Right. That yet. Streaming isn't a thing in theory, right?
Well, I mean, streaming might be a thing. As far as I know, the only computer that shows up in the books is at the school. And it's useless, so I don't know, like, how that's going to be adapted. I don't think we're going to suddenly live in a world where there are smartphones, but the fact that we had the streaming mentions means it could. There could be a smartphone joke in the end if they're on that island. Who knows? Yeah, okay. So, Joanna, how much about the back, like, the underlying story that is revealed in the Netflix series did you like know beforehand? So like, okay,
like
let me say specifically
Beatrice,
we get a scene
or...
of we get some stuff about Beatrice. We get the Lemony Snicket is dead newspaper clipping.
Mm-hmm.
We get a scene of Olaf talking to Poe about initially getting the orphans, which we didn't actually get to witness before. We get little peeks at things that are either from other books or from other ancillary material that have sort of been massaged in. And at least because I watched the series before I read those other things, I was like, holy crap, we're going to like meet a whole bunch of VFD agents.
Yeah. I mean, the VFD stuff was like much more prominent right from the start. You already said that like the larger arc wasn't as prominent, in the early books. They seem sort of standalone. I think what Daniel Handler said, and I'm so sorry because I do really keep citing this one interview, but it was a good one from a writer I really like at Entertainment Weekly, Mark Snitker. But he said that in a book, you can be really subtle about the way that you drop clues in for a long-reaching mystery, but in a TV show, you need to sort of like drop those anvils. So, knowing that. The secret society sort of stuff becomes so important later. I think it's good that they introduced some of that stuff early on. Is that what you're talking about? Or
yeah,
yeah.
I believe so. I mean, especially stuff with like Monty using the scope to decode the movie was something that was like a whole other layer added on top of that story to make it, you know, fold into the greater, I'm talking about the Reptile Room episode 2, I believe, but to fold into like the greater narrative. And then Jacqueline, who, Joanna, is this a gender bent Jax Snicket?
I think so. Like,
yes.
Yeah.
They hit that in Black Poe. I was very happy to find in this series. But yeah, her sort of, constant storyline as being a very active defender very early on of the Baudelaires was, I think, nice to see. But then again, like I was saying earlier, the more time you spend on that, the less time you're taking giving power to the Baudelaires as emotional characters. So I don't know. Neil, for instance.
Neil's like, I don't know what the fuck you're talking
about. Yeah, I'm lost.
So Neil, in the second episode.
Go on with your question.
It looks like the Baudelaires might be saved by the secret organization. There's a man named Gustav who's gets killed in a pond.
Yes.
Did that scene make any sense to you, considering they never come back to talk about it?
It didn't make sense until later, until Count Olaf showed up. And I was like, oh, yeah, all right. So he killed Gustav. But it didn't. I will say this. The secretary thing being part of the secret organization, I sort of picked that up early, because of all the symbol, that singular symbol that, you know, is all over the place. And it's part of the thing that he picks up at the house after it's burned down. So I think I started to pick up that there was something else going on. But as I said before, I was convinced that Will Arnett and Kobe Smulders were their parents, and that it was this secret organization, that there was some kind of plot that they were part of that was trying to get them back with their parents. But then by about the sixth episode, I was like, they probably could have done this by now. Like, someone could have said, hey, your parents are still alive. And I was, and so at that point, I was like, you know, maybe, maybe not. So.
The, you mentioned, like, there's a few, like, Awesome Mommy, Alfre Woodard, and, what's his name? Mr. Trick from Buffy. K. Todd Freeman are all, like, you know, all those characters were white in the movie. And, so I, you know, I thought that, you know, especially since we're talking about like aunts and uncles, like, I don't know, whatever. Well, I feel like it's 2017. We should like not even point out race blind casting. Cause it's like, you want to think that it's like, we're already past it and it's not a big deal, but like, it still winds up being a big deal sometimes. So I just like that. They were just like, whatever, it's all for whatever. It's Awesome Mommy, whatever. It's fine.
Well, I mean, by the time you soak up the entire book series, I feel like that's like the least of your worries with the actual facts I think you end up with. So it's like, we're talking about, what, like Hook-Handed Man, right?
Yeah.
Who is great, doesn't amount to anything in terms of the plot, but I got to watch him for 4 episodes and maybe appreciate that character for the first time because of the performance in the Netflix series.
Yeah.
So, like, more to that, and then I don't think, you know, I think if you were going to have the let's make a Baudelaire family tree at the end of this series, that would be a problem, but I almost guarantee you that's not going to happen. So
right.
I think we'll be okay. Actually, my favorite, I was looking up crazy... a series of unfortunate events theories on the internet, and my favorite one is that all the adults in the world are immortal. Almost every adult is immortal. And I have a webpage with a whole bunch of quotes talking about how you can't really clarify how old people are, and how there's a tradition in the VFD of naming your children after somebody who has died in your family previously. And that maybe we don't know how old any of these people are. And that maybe William Shakespeare is alive, apparently, it says in one of the books. So,
so
I think if the whole
crazy.
World exists in, like, this gender, you know, gender ethnic nonsense, that like, we're totally just finding the best performance is where she'd be.
You're crazy. You're
basically
my favorite.
What she said.
You're my favorite.
What? No, they're all
They're all immortal. Are they vampires?
Oh, VFD means Volunteer Fire Department.
Or does it mean Very Fast Delivery Service?
It's funny because there's a quote in the first episode where Lemony Snicket is talking about how the house burned down, and he talks about, isn't there a quote where he says like they had to call the fire department and the Volunteer Fire Department?
Oh yes, here we go. All the VFD phrases in season one of the series of unfortunate events. All of my associate and I have managed to learn is that neither the official fire department nor the volunteer fire department arrived in time to put out the blaze. Jacqueline says there's a vigorously fist destination your parents had in mind for you, and it is not with Count Olaf. The hook-handed henchman says, where are we going to go now, boss? And Count Olaf says, to a vigorously fixed destination. Second pair of episodes, Monty says it's a misnomer. Do you know what that means? Klaus says a very wrong name. Monty says a very fitting definition. The ticket seller says, I'm giving you the verified film discount. The opening credits of Zombie in the Snow read, Vatiated Film Distribution. Yes, I think I pronounced that right. Blah, 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 blah. The next pair of episodes, a sign in the shop windows outside of the lake that is not a sea says, Vastly Flavorful Desserts. A woman in the market is selling very fresh dill. The Quagmire parents decode a very far distant telegram. And Josephine says, Not long after this photograph was taken, your parents and I had to make a vastly frightening decision. Final two episodes. Sunny and Violent find an inscription for their father inside a verified functional dictionary. Charles says, but I can tell you they are just on the side of that very fancy door. And Mr. Quagmire says, there are fires all around us, figuratively and literally. And Miss Quagmire says, it's time we mount a vigorous fires defense. That's it. All the VFDs, first season. Thanks for bringing that up, Neil.
Yeah, cool.
Dave, Before we started recording, Dave threatened to lay all the Easter eggs on you guys. And I was like, surely you can't. But there, you, I mean, those aren't all of them. Please don't do all of them. Guys. Dear God. Okay. But those were all the VFDs. Good job.
I caught it. I caught one of them.
You did.
Yay.
Good job, Neil.
Yeah, Neil didn't even really know that he was supposed to be looking for the acronym.
Right.
So I think that's like being Neil Sardamas.
Yeah.
It is.
Being like, that's important.
I predict that that will continue in season two.
Oh, for sure. And like, okay, Joanna, book reader question moments.
Oh, no. Okay.
Did you catch?
I didn't reread the books. Okay, yes. Go ahead.
The Sugar Bowl shout out.
No.
Oh, so it's in episode two.
Oh, snap. Okay, go ahead.
Klaus comes in to tell Count Olaf that he's been up all night reading the marriage book, and he's gonna foil his thing. And Count Olaf says that he's having coffee, but he can't seem to find the sugar bowl.
Oh.
Neil, that's a series long MacGuffin in
the
books.
Yep, nothing.
Yes.
I got nothing.
Yep.
Totally in there.
Excellent.
And of course, Jacqueline has the harpoon, which Olaf will come across various other times. And then somebody that a Twitter listener fan of the show pointed out is at one point, Lemony Snicket tells you to pretend that someone's going to throw the Baudelaires a pony party. And if you take the Lemony Snicket unauthorized biography and flip its book jacket inside out, it becomes The Pony Party, a story about the luckiest kids in the world.
Wow.
Oh my God.
Buddy.
Yeah, man. That's not even the characters that we saw. I could keep going.
I know you could.
Like, I think we saw most like a majority of villains. We definitely know who burned down the fireplace at the end.
Uh huh. We sure do. The laser pointer.
Yeah, some sort of laser pointer through a mirror, which seems, you know, like doubly weird.
Yeah. You know what was super weird? Okay, so like you know that there's the third Quagmire sibling who is presumed dead, and whether or not they are, whatever, but like they're played by this, you know, the two boys in the family are played by the same actor, but that was like the most awkward split screen I've ever seen for like the same actor playing twins in my life.
Oh, if we're getting into polygon territory, there are serious problems with Sunny in this series.
Oh yeah,
just inconsistent from shot to shot. The head floats
right.
Over the dummy a couple of times.
Floats around the head. At one point, it had American Sniper baby fakeness going on. Where,
like, I'm sorry, I'll never stop laughing at the American Sniper.
I think it was toward the end, but there's like a where one of them sets Sunny down and like pets her head, and I'm like, that's not real. That's not real, baby. I know that's not real.
Yep.
I've seen stuff. So there's that.
Yep. No, it's, I mean, that maybe is going to get better. The kid ages, so at least that's in the book slightly. So if they're not going to have to constantly CG over a baby. But that being said, because the show was sort of like cartoony and pastel colored, occasionally they were able to hide, I think, the effects better. Like, I was really impressed with, like, a lot of the water-based effects and storm stuff from the middle episodes. And, like, having a car being able to drive around the same set that Patrick Warburton's on just seems like, you know, more of a film thing that Tim Burton would do than a Netflix film.
Yeah, apparently they tried to use painted canvas drops instead of green screen as much as possible, which is fun. But, yeah, some of the polygons were misshapen. And poorly.
Some of the baby things not work out.
But yeah, it was so awkward. It's when Will Arnett and Kobe Smulders are like walking into their home and their three children greet them. Like, watch that scene again, I dare you, and like explain to me why it looks as terrible as it does. But yeah, then one of those kids is gone in the last scene, and it's just the boy, one boy, one girl in the austere academy. Next season on A Series of Unfortunate Events, The Austere Academy, part one and part two.
Yep, and we'll pick it up, and maybe we'll figure out, if we're going to spend a whole bunch of time figuring out new answers. I don't think there's a ton that I would describe as new to the mythology. But that being said, I haven't read the four Lemony Snicket prequels. I will say that the last shot of the series that pushes through the academy to a picture of Snicket and Count Olaf as peers is exciting from a standpoint where living in this universe, you are not allowed to see Lemony Snicket's face. And then all of a sudden there's an existing photograph of him that I'm seeing. So well, really interested.
That's true of the owner of the mill. In the books, the owner of the mill is his face is completely obscure behind a cloud of smoke at all times. And actually in the opening credits, like when they're singing the song and you see the footage, like his face is behind smoke. But it's just Don Johnson. They're like, we're not going to do that. It's here's Don yeah. Johnson's face. It's fine. Yeah, I do know. I mean, like, I haven't read the unauthorized biography, but I do know that, like, you know, the Snicket character was, like, drafted in the VFD when he was young, as were his siblings. And that, yeah, and that he did go to school with Olaf, and that perhaps he and Beatrice are responsible for Olaf's parents' death.
For sure. I think that one's pretty solid in terms of, it's at the end of the show. I'm going to go all the way in.
Do it. Here I can't wait.
All right. The Penultimate Peril, the second to last book, is the one that contains all of these quotes that set up the Baudelaire parents as having murdered Count Olaf's, but murdered. It's Kit Snicket, a character that Neil knows nothing about. Says that, I remember that evening well. It was a performance of La Forza. Your mother was wearing a red shawl with long feathers around the edges. During intermission, I followed them to the snack bar and slipped them a box of poison darts before Esme Squalor could catch me. And then Lemony Snicket, later on in The Penultimate Pearl, says, on that fateful evening long ago, as I hurried out of the opera house before a certain woman could spot me, if it was the Fourth of Destiny that was guiding their story, or something even more mysterious, even more dangerous, even more unfortunate. Then, 100 pages later in The Penultimate Peril, Olaf's being questioned, and he says, I guess that sub-librarian hasn't told you the story about your parents, he said, and a box of poison darts. Why don't you ask them, orphans? Why don't you ask this legendary librarian about that fateful evening at the opera? And then in another more than 100 pages in The Penultimate Peril, Olaf says, or a character says to Olaf, tell me what is the weapon that left you an orphan, and I'll type it in for you. And Count Olaf gives Klaus a slow smile that, quote, made the Baudelaire shudder, subquote. I'll certainly tell you, he said. It was poison darts. So those four quotes, together suggest that the Baudelaire parents actually murdered Count Olaf's parents at some point, causing this whole fortune grabbing to begin. That's a lot more quoting out of books than I usually do. Usually I don't read the books.
Yeah, so if you watch this Netflix series, then either you've come along for the ride with us, or you have a lot of extra information now, or if you didn't see the series, maybe you're completely confused and you should go watch it.
Yeah, I wouldn't recommend going into our episodes without having seen the series at all. But maybe that was something I should have said at the beginning.
No, not that you have to say it, but I just know that sometimes people do that. I don't know why they just like the sound of our voices, but it was charming talking at you, people who haven't seen this series. I know people do that. Listen to our shows without having seen or read or consumed the pop culture we're about to talk about.
Okay, well, in that case, I'm going to ask, as a way of closing, I'm going to ask Neil for a star rating. Joanna, I'm going to ask you series or books for somebody that has done either. So, Neil.
Out of how many stars?
Five-star scale.
Oh, five stars.
Five stars.
I'm going to go with...
No fractions beyond half.
Oh, okay. I'm going to go 3.7. No.
Don't IGN me on this shit.
Yeah, I think 3.5, maybe 4 star. I mean, it's a good show. I liked it. I was charmed. I wanted to keep watching it. I was happy to binge it, and I look forward to finding out what the hell is going on in this boarding school. And I'm sad that their parents are really probably dead. So there's that.
That is very unfortunate.
But, you know, that's sort of on brand for this show.
Yeah, exactly. Joanna, did we doom Neil by making him watch this instead of reading the books first?
Did we doom him?
Oh, I guess that's a very Lemony Snicket overstating.
Okay. I didn't know if you said do or doom.
Oh, I said doom. Doom.
Yeah, we doomed him. We did. The books are better.
Oh,
the books are better. Okay. Come on. Right. Come on.
Could I? That's, here's a question,
that's
though.
Much always the case.
Could I, like I did with Game of Thrones season 2, could I just pick up the books for the story after what we've seen so far?
Yeah.
Oh, all right.
Yeah.
Well, then maybe
You'll
I'll do that before
be
the next
slightly
season.
Ahead of them, I think.
Interesting.
Yeah. You got some time, and then I will make sure to read the Lemony Snicket prequels before next season, so maybe I'll have more stuff to say.
So I guess we're doing this in 2018. they're fast reads. They're short books. They're, you know, breezy. They're fun.
And except for 2, Tim Curry does the audiobooks, and if not Patrick Warburton, Tim Curry is a pretty good substitute for a Lemony Snicket voice in your head. Let me tell you.
All right. All right. That works.
Yeah. All right. Well, I think that wraps up Series of Unfortunate Events. As always, Neil's going to give us a little preview of what we're doing next week.
Yes. Yes. Next week, since we are encroaching on February, by the time you listen to this, it'll be February. By the time we get to our next episode, we'll be well into February. Or February, for those who are...
Sobruary. Wait for me. I'll be sober.
Oh, wow. Yes. Then this will go really well, I'm sure. Our next episode is going to be called Romancing the Storm, which will include multiple things, including us talking about some memorable date movies that we've had in our lives, maybe some of our favorite romantic films. Also, it's going to be sort of a mini mailbag episode. So if you have questions... I'm trying to think of the best way to phrase this. If you just have questions about romance and love and life and things that you should show your significant other, movie related and TV related, not weird stuff.
I reviewed some pornography.
This has
so,
gone
you know,
down.
Not,
this has gone downhill.
I know.
So
see, there's
yeah,
no good way to
well,
say
can
this.
I, wait, can I try this? Can I try it instead?
Yes.
I think what we're looking for are questions that are loosely tied around the theme of love. So I would accept from you, our kind listener, a request for relationship advice. We don't promise to give good advice, but we can give advice. Adjudicating fights between couples. I would do that. Pop culture fights between couples. I would do that.
This is just going to be us arguing a whole bunch of stuff. I like this. Let's do that.
Adjudicating, like fictional couples. Like if you're like, it should have been Dawson and not Pacey or something better than that.
Team Rory and books.
Yeah, there you go. Team Rory and books. Team Rory and know when she's the worst. So stuff like that. So if it's on a love theme, I mean, you know, send us your questions to @StormofSpoilers or StormofSpoilers@gmail.com. We will pick the ones that we think tie closest to the theme, but that's the very loose theme that we're going with. And we had a really fun time with the mailbag episode last time. So please do send us all your questions. Is that what we're looking for?
Yeah. I mean, so send us all that stuff, and then Dave and I will answer anything else you guys want to know.
Yeah, we will answer the stuff that Joanna's like, no. I'll be like, butt plug should be wide at the base for health reasons.
Sex is fine. I'm not saying no sex. We can talk about but Neil was like, send us your questions about life. I'm like, well, let's narrow it down to like,
oh, okay. That makes
love
sense.
And sex, love and sex and romance. Like,
we'll save
no
life advice,
advice
for,
yeah,
for
yeah, yeah.
Our celebration of Life Day later
so
in the year.
Yes.
So I would say love and sex and romance. That's the umbrella, right?
Because that's
it deserves to be love and romance.
Because
right?
If we're honest, that's all you've ever wanted from us anyway. So now's your chance.
The Valentine's Day. Valentine's Day podcast.
Valentine's Day.
Romancing the Storm.
Yeah. We need more of that. More love, sex, and romance.
Yeah.
But until then, Neil, where can they find some of your work online, which is just as good as some of those things?
Wow, that was that's
actually
the best,
all of those
that's
things.
The best compliment
your,
that I've
your
gotten.
Your stuff is just as good as all of those
time.
Things. I've definitely had more disappointing sex than things I've read on Film School Rejects.
Well, if you'd like to test that theory, filmschoolrejects.com is where I'll be. I'm finishing up my Sundance coverage still. And you can follow me on Twitter at Rejects. And as Joanna said, don't forget to follow the show and tweet your questions at us at Storm of Spoilers or email us stormofspoilers@gmail.com.
And Joanna Robinson?
You can find me on Twitter at Better Than Romance. I'm not promising better than sex. or on vanityfair.com. Or you can listen to me talk about non-sex, romance, and love things on Little Gold Men, Gen Pop, and that's it.
Oh, you haven't added any new podcasts in the last week?
Wait, no, I was on another podcast. Hold on. Like, stop. Stall for me while I find it. Hold on.
So you want to know something interesting I learned on Twitter this week, Neil?
Sure.
Tweeting about Trump, all my opinions, people seem to get mad about that. Tweeted twice about Ben Affleck Batman opinions, have not stopped getting at it all day.
Man, if only you could combine the two and be like, Trump should direct the next Batman movie.
I'd be in for that. I mean, if he didn't have another job to do, but maybe we could clear...
They make it really easy because they put the Batman Superman logo on their profile photo on Twitter. They're so easy to mute and block. Okay,
it's just like the Pepe thing. It's like, yeah. I mean, what do you think was going to happen here?
Yeah, exactly. Okay, the podcast is actually hosted by my roommate and her friend, and they were recording on a Saturday, and they wrote me in. It's called This Isn't New. And I got to play a game. This is ties into our Romancing the Storm thing. I got to play a game, which is really fun, called Real or Fake, Contraceptive Edition, where my roommate gave me a quiz of weird things that people have used as contraceptives throughout the years, and I had to decide whether or not it was a real thing that people had done or a fake thing that she had made up. So it was really hard.
I am subscribing to this right now.
So yeah, it's This Isn't New. The Twitter handle is at This Isn't New. I think the episode's up January 31st, which is today when we're recording, but it might be February 1st. Anyway, I'll be on there.
Excellent. And I'm Dave Gonzalez on Twitter at DA70, arguing that Batman ruined Ben Affleck. Not the other way around, guys. Settle down. Jesus. And so until next week, I love all of you. Please love me back.